Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. To begin today's broadcast, host Keith Brown L. talks with JJ, a woman that tried to help a lost child and in that effort was roughed up and arrested when she tried to film an off-duty KCPD police officer. Then, host Margot Patterson talks with Melanie Austin, Director of Education at MOXA, the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. They will talk about MOXA's programs and what constitutes sexual assault and harassment. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Keith and his guest.
Many so-called law enforcement officials in America do not like to be video recorded by citizens while they, the officers, are engaging in illegal activity or otherwise improper behavior. However, the United States Supreme Court has clearly held that citizens have a constitutional right to video record such events and that our phones and our cameras cannot be taken away to prevent us from recording and that we cannot be detained or placed under arrest for doing so. One of the strategies police have developed to combat this is to somehow provoke a confrontation with the camera recording citizen and then use this as an excuse to approach the person in a hostile, aggressive manner and then physically abuse the citizen if he or she is allegedly refusing to cooperate or resisting arrest. This has become all too common on the streets of America and is being perpetrated against innocent law-abiding people by those who are supposed to protect and serve us. In a few minutes, we are going to hear all about this from our guests on today's show. And you are also going to hear about the continuing pattern of abuse and mistreatment of prisoners in the Jackson County Jail. My name is Keith Brownhill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
No, this is my right as an American citizen. No, 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 hold this. No, 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 this is my right. Why are you doing this?
Put your hands behind your back.
No, 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 no!
What is your name?
JJ.
What's your age?
36.
Where do you live?
Kansas City, Missouri.
How long have you lived there?
I've lived in the metro area my entire life.
Are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
Yes.
How many?
Four.
What is your racial background?
I'm Hispanic. I'm mixed.
Did you ever have an encounter or an altercation with someone in the Kansas City Police Department?
Yes.
Do you remember the date?
Yes.
How long ago was it?
This would have been last April, April 8th.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes. When I got to the Quick Trip on 41st and Main, I proceeded to the door. I was making sure that my vehicle was locked and that I had my ID and my debit card so that I could purchase a pack of cigarettes. And when I looked up, there was a police officer. Well, at least I thought it was a police officer because he had a Kansas City police officer
vest
on and the vest, yes. And I looked up. He had a snake around his arm, and it startled me. So I go, oh, is that police issued? And I kind of just laughed and he just gave me a dirty look, and then I proceeded to the front door, and a little girl came in front of me, and she walked up to the police officer and asked him if he could help her find her brothers and sisters. They're younger than her. She doesn't know where they're at. And I stopped to listen. He said, how old are you? And she said, I'm 12. And he said, where is your mother? She said, I don't know. And she really looked kind of like sad about it. And that broke my heart. So I continued to listen. And he goes, well, I don't know what to tell you. At that point, being a mother of four, I got really kind of angry that he acted like he couldn't help her. And I know that Quick Trip is a safe place. And maybe she knew that. And maybe that's why she was there. I don't know how old her brothers and sisters are because he didn't ask and I didn't ask. But at that point, I said, well, I know what to tell her. I said, I'm willing to help this little girl. I said, I asked her if she would like to use my phone. She said, yes. I unlocked it for her and she did dial a number. At this point, the police officer's like, no, why don't you just use my phone? And he tried to, like, shove it on her, and she didn't want it. She shied away from him. At that point, he said, you need to leave. And I said, well, I'm not going to leave because I don't feel that you're doing your job. And so I am going to help this little girl. I'm going to make sure that she finds her mother and her siblings or a family member. And he said, you need to leave right now. I said, I haven't done anything wrong. I don't need to leave. I'm going to help her, and then I'm going to purchase my cigarettes, and then I'm going to go home.
Now, where is this location you was at again? I forgot.
This was at 41st and Main at the Quick Trip. And he then says, you need to leave now, and that's an order. And so at that point, I said, you know, I don't take orders from you. I haven't done anything wrong. I haven't committed a crime. And I said, as a matter of fact, I'm going to get your name and your badge number, and I'm going to record it. At that point, I took out my phone and started to record, and he tried to grab my phone repeatedly out of my hand. I gave it to the little girl and asked her to hold on to it. At that point, he throws me on the ground and starts to basically manhandle me. He throws me onto my stomach, and then he cuffs me. He picks me up. He slams me back on the ground on my back. And then proceeds to hold me down with his knee.
You know what this officer's name was?
Yes, Donald Ebert.
All right, how tall are you?
I'm 5'4", 5'5".
How much do you weigh?
Probably 130 pounds.
Right, how much did this officer weigh? How tall was he?
He was probably 5'9", maybe. And I'm pretty sure he was around 200 pounds.
200 plus or just 200?
Yeah, it could be 200 plus, yeah. Okay. Especially with all the heavy equipment he was wearing.
So he was probably just slinging you around like a little rag doll.
Pretty much, that's what happened. And I have pictures of bruises that I have on my arms where there's like four dots on the inner part of my arm. And then I had a knot on my arm that didn't go away for like 3 months. It was bruised at one point, but then after the bruise went away, there was like a quarter-size knot in my arm for about 3 months. But I have pictures of all the handprint bruises, fingerprint bruises, all over my arms. I had bruises all over my legs. I had bruises on my wrists and my ankles from the shackles that they put me in. I had 3 panic attacks during this entire thing in which another female officer showed up and was screaming in my face for me to tell her what was wrong with me. But I could not breathe. So I could not talk. And she was yelling at me for me to stop doing that and for me to tell her what was wrong with me.
Okay, now this was a white police officer that initiated this, right?
Correct.
And what was the racial identity of the woman that was yelling and screaming at you?
White.
And what do you go through when you're having a panic attack? Explain what happens and
usually,
what causes you to have it.
Okay, so usually when I have a panic attack, it kind of just feels like you have an elephant sitting on your chest. It's kind of hard to breathe. And I get real anxious and nervous, which causes that. That time, it was a lot different. I could not breathe at all. I was so scared. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know why I was being arrested. Nobody told me why. I didn't have any rights read to me. I just got manhandled by this male cop. Yeah, this gorilla. And, you know, now I'm shackled and they're going to put me in a paddy wagon. And I had never been treated like that. I'd never been through something like that, especially while trying to help somebody.
Okay, what have you had panic attacks before?
Yes, but none that severe. Like, I literally could not breathe. And it scared me. Just, if you can't breathe, it makes you panic more because it almost feels like you're suffocating, but you can't stop it.
What kind of medical condition is this that causes you to have that?
It's called anxiety.
Anxiety.
I have, yeah, very high anxiety, mm-hmm. In which I do receive medication from my doctor.
Were there any no trespasser signs at this Quick Trip? Anything warning the public that they can't lie there or anything like that?
No, the only thing I saw was a sign that said it's a safe place. or a safe space, something like that.
Well, it didn't seem to be very safe for you.
No, and it didn't seem very safe for the little girl, and that's another thing. The worst part to me about this is the fact that I still don't know if that little girl ever found her family.
So, in other words, what he did is he turned all of his attention away from helping the little girl who was looking for her siblings and her mother, and he decided to concentrate on trying to find an excuse to arrest you.
Yeah. He tried to take my phone when I tried to video him, first off, and then when I wouldn't let him have my phone and I handed it to the little girl, that's when he decided to physically, in my opinion, attack me.
Okay, so what happened when you when after they got you into the police wagon?
At that point, I had another panic attack. I had calmed down after the lady was done screaming at me. It took a few minutes. I don't know how long. I do remember my chest hurting once I got into the paddy wagon. I'm not sure if that's from him slamming me around, having panic attacks, or putting his knees into my chest. I'm not sure why, but my chest started hurting. And
well, he put his knee in your chest.
Yes, after he slammed me on the front of my body, and then he picked me up and then slammed me on my back, and my head hit the ground. Then he decided to not only hold my shoulders down, but put his knee into my chest until other officers arrived. But anyway, at that point, when I got into the paddy wagon, I had another panic attack. And it, again, scared me so bad, I didn't know if I was going to suffocate to death or not. So I started, I don't know if I was banging on the paddy wagon door with my knee or my hand, but I was trying to get somebody's attention because I was scared that I was not going to be able to breathe and die. And so nobody ever opened the door, but I did receive a ticket for that, stating that I was being belligerent in the paddy wagon. When I got out of jail, I received one trespassing ticket and one obstruction and resist ticket. The belligerent in the paddy wagon ticket was also an obstruction and resist, but I didn't get that until maybe a week after I had gotten home. I got that one in the mail.
Now, during the time when you were being manhandled by this officer, is there any point that he could legitimately say that you were doing anything to resist? Were you offering him any resistance whatsoever?
I was telling him no. Stop, and asking him why he was arresting me. Why was he doing this? And he did not say anything.
And he interpreted that as resistance?
Apparently so, yes. Me telling him that I was exercising my rights, no, why are you doing this? Stop. That apparently was resisting.
And you had a portion of this recorded on videotape. You didn't get it from the beginning, but you did get some of it recorded on your phone.
Yes, because I had told him I was going to record his name and badge number. And when I started recording, he tried to grab my phone, and then I gave it to the little girl. I don't know that she knew I was recording because it's just, you can see the sidewalk, but you can hear me clearly stating, stop, no, why are you doing this? No, and then I start screaming because he's hurting me.
Well, did you ever get your phone back?
I got it when I got out of jail. They put it in my property.
Now, this lady that was screaming and hollering at you, who was she? Was she a supervisor or somebody, or just another police officer?
I don't actually know. I assume she was another police officer because I did ask for a supervisor, and he did show up, and I stated my complaint, and he said he didn't care.
And what, was he a sergeant?
I believe so. I do not remember. I was in a state of panic at that point, and I had been roughed up. I don't remember much of our interaction because it's very brief.
Okay, what happened after all of this?
They take me to the Jackson County Correctional Facility. When I get there, I have another panic attack due to the fact that I had my hair up in a ponytail kind of thing, and they ripped it out of my head.
The ponytail?
They asked me to take it out, and I told them that I couldn't because my hands are in cuffs. Therefore, they ripped it out of my hair. They didn't take it out. They grabbed my hair and ripped the ponytail out. And I had another panic attack.
Now, who did this?
This was whoever was booking me. It was a lady with red hair.
And you never got her name?
No, I did not.
What happened after that?
I remember them joking around. I had a safety pin in my ear where I have a piercing. And I remember hearing them joking about that, saying, oh, she's got a safety pin in her ear. Ha, ha, ha. And they said, yank it out. I didn't find that funny, especially after they had just yanked out my ponytail holder. I thought they were actually going to yank it out, and I had another panic attack then.
You have other piercings on your body too, don't you?
Yes.
Where?
I have one in my nose.
Was it there at the time you were being buffed up?
Yes.
And did they try to remove that or anything?
Yes. But they didn't know how to take it out, and I was not going to offer that information to them.
So they just let you keep it in?
Yes.
Okay, now you're down in the police station. I guess you're being booked in.
Yeah.
What happened after that?
They put me in a cell.
Did they do a search? Did they do a body search or anything, or strip search?
Nope.
What jail did you go to?
Jackson County.
Okay.
Downtown, across from the federal building.
But you were in the city part of the jail, not the actual county. You were in the part where they keep the city prisoners, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. And they didn't do any searches on you or anything?
No.
Did they take your clothing from you?
No.
And what happened then?
They did take my shoes, though, so I got to walk around in socks.
Okay.
Yeah. They put me in the cell. They threw some kind of little mat in there and told me to go to sleep. It was, I think, by the time I got in there and booked and all, it was 3 a.m. At this point, my chest hurt. I was very distraught. I knew I had been mistreated. I knew that what was happening was not normal, and I didn't think it was legal. So I refused to go to sleep, which is what they're telling me to do. And so I told them that I needed to see a doctor.
Right.
Because my chest hurt.
That was my next question.
Yes, I did. And they said I could when they felt like it.
Did you ever get a chance to see a doctor?
Yes. This was several hours later, probably 5 hours later. I went into where the nurses or doctors were, and I had told them what was going on. And they wanted me to sign some papers that I wasn't comfortable with signing. I don't remember what it entailed. I don't remember why I didn't want to sign them at this juncture, but I refused to sign them, and so they refused to treat me.
You never left the cell after you was placed in it, right?
No, I did ask for a phone call, mm-hmm. but I was not ever allowed to make that phone call.
Mm-hmm. And did anybody ever inform you of why you were arrested or why you were taken into custody?
No.
When did you learn about this?
When I left jail, I had some tickets in my property, mm-hmm. and I read them. And that's when I found out why.
Did you ever appear in front of a judge?
Yes, I did, actually last week, last Thursday.
I mean, prior to you being released?
Oh, no.
You never seen a judge?
No.
They just locked you up and they held you and then they let you go?
Yes.
And then they gave you a court date? They assigned you, the police assigned you a court date?
Yes, yes. And then a week after I got out of jail, I got another ticket in the mail. Another obstruction and resist.
Now, what are they saying you actually did? Did the tickets explain anything, or they just stated the general allegation about you resisting?
Yes, one of the tickets said that I basically was interfering with the police officer's investigation of a call of a missing juvenile. But this, I find that very funny because this officer was off duty, number one, working as a security guard, number two, for Quick Trip.
In his uniform.
But if you're off duty, my question is, how can you respond to a call if you're off duty? Last I knew, if you're off duty, you know, they don't call you at home and say, hey, we need you to go over to Commerce Bank because it's being robbed. They call a police officer who's actually on duty to respond. And so one of the tickets said that he was responding to a call of a missing juvenile, and I was interfering. I was obstructing.
Well, you said when you first encountered him, he was standing outside playing with a snake, right?
Yes. He was also talking to some girl that had some really short shorts on and other cleavage. Just, okay. She was kind of dressed promiscuously, provocatively. It appeared to me that he was flirting with her. And I don't know if he was showing this snake off to her or if it was her snake and he was holding it. I'm unclear on what that was about. All I know is that's what I walked up on. So he didn't appear to be investigating anything, especially in regards to this child. And as a matter of fact, the child wasn't even there. The child walked up right as I was getting ready to enter the Quick Trip door.
Well, let's hope in the future that you won't have to have any more dealings with them, especially in that situation like the one you just described a few minutes ago. You know, everybody has to try to get together and do what they can and try to see if they can prevent situations like that from happening again, because it's obvious that they're not giving anybody any type of consideration as far as what their rights are as citizens anymore. It doesn't even seem like you live in a country where they continuously brag about their freedoms and how great this country is, but you don't see these things unfolding and taking place.
I don't feel free.
And you're an example.
I will never feel free again.
Yeah. Well, like I said, thank you. I appreciate you coming, and we'll keep continuing to work. And if you hear of any other incidents like this or you know anything about it, get in touch with me.
Definitely.
And see if I can get it out in the public.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, the calendar for November 27th. The Cross Border Network's monthly meeting will be today, Monday, November 27th, 6:30 p.m. at the Kauffman Foundation, 4801 Rock Hill Road, KCMO. They will be making plans for a protest of President Trump's December visit to Kansas in support of Kris Kobach's gubernatorial campaign. Mama on a Mission and the Chipotle restaurant in the Blue Ridge Crossing Shoppings area, 4151 Sterling, KCMO, are teaming up to help the family of murder victim Marcel Smith. 50% of the proceeds taken in from 4 to 8 p.m. today, Monday, November 27th, will go to help pay for his funeral. You must tell the cashier that you want part of your proceeds to go to Mama on a Mission. Marcel was murdered on September 8, 2017. He was 36 years old and left behind two children and was Kansas City's 106th homicide of 2017. Wyandotte County Attorney Mark Dupree is investigating former KCK Detective Robert Golubsky. He is asking anyone with information on corruption and violations of the law committed by Detective Golubsky to contact his office. You can call them at 913-573-2851 or 913-573-2948. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, December 1st, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. This month, Empower Missouri's Executive Director and former Missouri State Representative Jeanette Mott Oxford will outline priorities for the coming year and their plans to mobilize to promote equity through policies in Missouri. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Margot and her guest.
This is Marco Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. The last few months have seen a remarkable spate of charges against prominent men in the media, Hollywood, and politics who are accused of sexual assault or harassment. Some observers are suggesting the number of women coming forward with accusations, followed in some cases by the accused losing his job, constitutes a watershed moment in our culture. Certainly, it has publicized and highlighted the problem of sexual assault in a new way. Here today to talk about that problem is Melanie Austin, Director of Education at MOXA, the acronym of the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. Melanie, the flood of accusations that we've seen has been eye-opening, but also bewildering, partly because the offenses named have been so different, ranging from the molestation of minors to lewd behavior to harassment of female employees to unwanted touching and sexual advances. I'm probably not the only person to learn that sexual assault is a broader category than I had realized. Could you clarify for me and other listeners what legally constitutes sexual assault?
Sure. It's important to keep in mind here that different states have different laws talking about what sexual assault is, what rape is, child sexual abuse. So what we do at MOXA is we talk about sexual violence as kind of being an umbrella term. And there are several terms that fall underneath that umbrella. So under the term of sexual violence, you have child sexual abuse, you have sexual harassment, you have rape, sexual assault, sodomy. So you have all these different terms that kind of fall under this big general umbrella. And so, you know, sexual harassment can be any unwanted behavior of a sexual nature. And that can be verbal, that can be physical, that can be written. So that kind of is how we would define sexual harassment. And sexual assault can include unwanted touching of a private part of your body. And rape would be unwanted intercourse. So kind of just general definitions, but very important to know that while states have very similar laws, each state has kind of different laws when it comes to sexual abuse and assault.
And how prevalent is sexual assault? And I don't know if you would know this. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to, you know, give us the statistics for the frequency of rape versus other forms of sexual assault?
Yeah, I don't know if I can give you an exact stat, but I can tell you a very common stat use is that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will experience sexual abuse or assault by the time they're 18 years old. So that's a lot. You're talking 25% of girls. And then there's another stat that 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men will experience sexual assault or rape at some point throughout their lifetime.
And how frequently do victims step forward to seek some kind of redress?
It's not very often. People don't step forward because there's a lot of shame, stigma, guilt, people not believing them when they want to come forward. So very few people actually report.
And as far as responding to victims of sexual assault, what kind of changes do you and others at MOXA see as necessary on the part of police or employers or the public? What are the kind of changes you'd like to see that would encourage more victims to come forward?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we can do is just believe people. So a lot of times you'll, let's say if there was alcohol involved. Well, if I disclose to you, well, I was at this party and I drank too much and I was sexually assaulted or I was raped. Well, if I, you know, as your friend, disclose that to you and then you say, well, what were you doing at the party? Why did you go there? That automatically assumes that I'm to blame for what happened. But we know that nobody should ever have to be the victim of a crime or experience that, no matter what you're doing. You know, nobody deserves that. And so it's important to start by believing somebody when they disclose what's happened. And so we as a general public, as friends and family, can believe someone when they disclose that they've experienced abuse or assault. And then as far as responses from police or from other people, I think we're starting to see people starting with believing the mm-hmm. survivor. And one of the things that we do at Mox is we actually provide training to police officers in the metro area on how to respond to victims, on trauma. And so that's really important. They have our phone number so they can call us and Moxa can be there while someone's giving a report to a police officer. We can send an advocate. So that's really important. We also have something around the metro. We have different, what they're called, SARTs. So they're sexual assault response teams. And so those teams are, you know, prosecutors, law enforcement, victim advocates, the crime lab is there. So we have these groups of people coming together to figure out how can we make the system better and respond better when we have victims that are coming forward. So I think the important thing is we're seeing that happening, and especially here in the Kansas City metro area, you know, working with our partners to make sure that the response is positive when people do come forward.
I'm curious about your training, the training that you all give to police. Mm-hmm. What kinds of resistance do you meet, if any, and what is it that you tell the police they should try to do when they meet a victim of sexual assault?
Sure. Again, it's just that message of starting by believing, and then I think explaining how trauma affects survivors. So oftentimes when someone experiences something traumatic, such as sexual assault or rape, you might have heard of that fight, flight, or freeze response. So when you're experiencing something traumatic, you're going to either try to get away or you might freeze totally. And you might think that you're going to respond one way, but when you're actually experiencing something, you're going to respond a totally different way. And so oftentimes people do freeze. And so right away, helping someone to understand that just because you didn't try to kick or run away doesn't mean that what happened to you wasn't an assault, right? So understanding that common response that we as humans experience is really important. And then also understanding how trauma affects our brain. So because it has such a powerful effect on our brain, it can also affect how we remember things. So oftentimes a victim will maybe they won't remember things in like chronological order. So that can be kind of confusing and make them seem like they're not as credible because they're not remembering it in chronological order. But really they can't because of how that trauma has impacted our brain. And so they'll remember bits and pieces. They might remember how something smelled or get flashes of things. So oftentimes we've even heard of survivors telling their stories, you know, like this memory came to me, you know, 3 years after the assault. And I don't know why I couldn't remember it at the time. But we know that the research shows that trauma impacts our brain and how we're able to remember things. So when we provide training with police officers, we talk about how that trauma impacts brains. And so it can help them to, when they're asking their questions, to think about what kinds of questions they're asking victims, to also help them to believe that person right away, you know, with what's happened, because it can be easy to not believe someone when things are out of order. You know, because they're like, well, that doesn't make sense, right? But so those are some of the things that we, some of the training, you know, just talking about believing someone right away, talking about how trauma impacts them and their brain and how that can impact their responses. And I think that kind of training helps officers know how to respond to victims. And so often we'll go to the police academies and provide training to new cadets, which is, I think, really awesome. We'll do role playing. So we'll often role play different things that a victim might say or do. And I think that's really helpful to role play those skills too.
How many people come to you all in the course of a year?
Oh, that's a great question. Let's see. Moxa overall sees over 60,000 people a year. That's through our various services. We have education, we do advocacy, and we have counseling. I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I think we served over 900 people through our advocacy work last year, and I believe over 1,100 for counseling. So we do serve the whole metropolitan area on both Kansas and Missouri, and then we also have outreach locations available. So if someone can't come to our main office, which is off 31st and Broadway here in Kansas City, they can go to an outreach location throughout the metro to receive counseling services. And then as far as and when a victim experiences a sexual assault or a rape, if they go to an area hospital, to like the emergency room, to have a forensic exam done, MOXA will be there. We get called by our hospitals to come and provide advocacy. So we do go out to all the hospitals when a victim shows up. And then we also do education, and we go throughout the metro. So we're in over 30 school districts. As I said, we provide training with police and nurses and school staff and just general adults in the community. So we see quite a few people.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice, KKFI Radio. And if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Melanie Austin, Director of Education at the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, or as it's widely known, MOXA. Melanie, I'm wondering if in your own mind you have any explanation for this eruption of revelations we're seeing right now that we're hearing so much about in the press. Do you think we're seeing a greater intolerance of sexual assault on the part of the public, or a different way of responding to it, or is this just a kind of sui generis moment?
Yeah,
what's your assessment of that?
I think that's a great question. There, you know, it's complex. I think there's a lot of reasons why we are seeing people coming forward. One of the biggest things, though, is I think people are feeling safer to come forward. And we're seeing that there is an intolerance for this. We're asking for, you know, for respect and for these things not to happen, especially as women. You know, we deserve to be treated equally and to not have to take experiencing sexual harassment or sexual abuse or assault. And we do know that this happens to men as well. So I want to make sure I point that out. But I think that we're seeing that victims are feeling safer to come forward. We still have an awful lot of victim blaming in our society where we say, well, why was she wearing that? Why was she drinking that? You know, and so why was she out walking alone? So we do still have a lot of victim blaming, and we make people feel ashamed or guilty for what they've experienced, you know? With that said, I think that we're seeing our community being more supportive of victims coming forward. And so that's really promising, I think. And while it can be difficult to hear, because it just seems like a flood of one thing after another, after another, after another, while it can be difficult to hear, I think that that speaks volumes to the fact that we as a society are saying that this behavior is not okay, and that we need to do something about it.
Well, you've mentioned victim blaming. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you if there are any common misconceptions that exist about sexual assault. Maybe victim blaming is one of them. I don't know. Are there others, or is it mainly people looking too much at the victim's behavior and not enough to what the perpetrator is doing?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's definitely other common misconceptions. One is that most people actually know their perpetrator. So oftentimes we might see in the media, especially when it comes to something like rape, oh, it's a stranger jumping out of the bushes. You know, you might hear that. But really, it's somebody that you know. And I think it's like over 86% of cases of sexual abuse and assault, the perpetrator is known to the victim. And that's difficult, because if you're talking about sexual abuse within a family, or it's somebody that you know, a friend or somebody that you know and love, somebody that you work with, that can be difficult to come forward, I think.
Does MOXA also see not only victims, but perpetrators? I'm wondering, where do people who are either perpetrators or who feel possibly tempted to do that, is there a place for them to go?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually do see offenders. They're court ordered to come. They're usually low level offenders, court ordered to come through our counseling program. It's actually the one service that we provide that they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to pay for the services that they're receiving. But we see it as our part of helping prevent sexual abuse and assault in our community, as providing counseling services for those offenders that are ordered to come to our services. Can I say one more thing too? They are not seen at our offices. We don't ever have victims and offenders coming to the same location. So they are seen at an offsite location.
Oh, interesting. And in terms of the offenders, what are the problems that you're working on with them, and what are the resistances, if any, that offenders may bring to the process?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't know if I can answer that specifically, because I myself don't work specifically with our offenders in that program. So as far as resistances, I'm not really sure. I can tell you that with all of our counseling programs, you know, we're just working to help people heal and to get better.
You mentioned in the few minutes we had before this interview, bystander skills. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by learning that there are things that can be done to prevent sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about prevention and then talk a little bit about these bystanders skills that you mentioned?
Yes, I would love to. That's one of the things that I get to do every day, is talk about how can we prevent this from happening. And a lot of people do want to intervene, and a lot of people do want to prevent this from happening, but they just might not have the skills on how to do that. So I kind of equate it to, so I'm also a fitness instructor on the side. And so I have to take classes on CPR and first aid. So if I ever encounter somebody who's having a health issue, I can respond appropriately because I have the skills to do that. So I kind of see our bystander intervention skills in that way. If I know how to respond, recognize a situation, and then how to respond to that, then I can intervene skillfully, feel confident in my skills, and prevent sexual violence from happening. So three skills that we talk about are that you can intervene directly. So you can say something to someone directly to get them to stop their behavior. You can get others to help. So we talk a lot about this with students. So students can get their friends to help. You know, they can talk to a teacher about it. As adults, we can get other adults around us to help. We can call the police or call 911. You can also create a distraction. So this is a great option. So if you're not exactly sure about what might happen, but you get the feeling that something's off and you're worried about the safety of somebody else, you can just totally change the subject. You can say, oh, hey, I think someone's calling you and needs you over there. Oh, are those your keys? Did you drop them? So just create a distraction and try to intervene in that exact moment. And that is obviously really popular with especially like middle school students who don't always feel comfortable directly intervening. It's always, always important too to assess your safety. So if you're not feeling safe to intervene, the get others to help is a great option. So what we'll do when we do education over bias intervention skills, we'll often do role plays with youth and adults so that they can practice those skills.
Well, you mentioned going to a lot of schools. Mm-hmm. Are most, you know, students in public schools, do they get this kind of education and training?
That's a great question. I don't know. I will say that here at Moxa, we in middle and high school, we see about 23,000 students a year. So they're getting some form of education on sexual harassment, on consent, on bystander intervention skills. And so that's really positive. And I also think our youth really get it. They really get that this, you know, sexual violence and harassment, you know, that we shouldn't tolerate that. And they understand that they have a role to play in preventing that. So I think it's really positive when we go out and see students doing that. But as far as other areas in the U.S., I'm not sure I know there's other organizations around the U.S. that exist like MOXA that do provide education. There are other organizations in the metro area that provide some education, especially when it comes to like dating violence and intimate partner violence as well. So that's positive.
We're seeing discussed right now many different kinds of misconduct, from the very serious mm-hmm. allegations made about Harvey Weinstein, for example, to less serious charges brought against some of the other men who have been publicly identified. Do you see the conflation of different types of behavior as something that could conceivably backfire in terms of public reaction?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think it's just an opportunity for education. And the important thing to remember is that anytime something is unwanted, especially when it's of a sexual nature, that can be considered sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape. So it's an important opportunity to talk about what consent is, to talk about boundaries, and that it's okay for people to have boundaries and assert those boundaries is really important. And when we were talking before, I mentioned this idea of thinking about sexual violence on this continuum, where you have maybe verbal sexual harassment down on one end, all the way up to on the opposite end, you have really egregious acts like rape and sexual assault. And so in society, when we accept these things at the lower end, you know, a joke, well, I was just joking. You know, when we accept those behaviors, then that makes it more difficult for people to come forward. It makes it easier for perpetrators to behave in the way that they are and to perpetrate more. And so that's why it's really positive, I think, that people are coming forward talking about the sexual harassment they've experienced or the rape or sexual assault that they've experienced. Because if it's unwanted, we shouldn't be tolerating that kind of behavior as a society, and we should be doing something about it. So I do think it's positive. I think it can be hard, though. It can be triggering, especially we know we have a lot of victims and survivors out there, so it can be very triggering for those people. Important to know that they can get help at places like MOXA. You know.
Well, yes, and you mentioned that you've received a lot of calls recently, which seem mm-hmm. to be triggered by this public attention. Mm-hmm. The women who call you are women and men, mm-hmm. what are they seeking from you?
Sure. Sometimes they just aren't sure what to do. I've experienced this. What can I do? So we're there to just provide some information about resources that might be available to them, how we can help them. We help people no matter what point they experience their abuse or assault. So I personally have taken calls on our crisis line where someone maybe had experienced child sexual abuse when they were a kid and they never told anybody. And here it is 40 years later, and they're still suffering from the consequences of that. And so now they're ready to get some healing, or maybe they finally learn that there's some place available that can help them. And so, we provide a lot of evidence-based counseling. We know it's really effective.
What is evidence-based counseling?
Yeah, it just means that it's shown through research to be effective in helping people to heal. And I think that's really positive.
Now this might be a good time for you to mention the MOXA hotline number.
So if you have any questions at all, if you've ever experienced sexual abuse or assault or know someone that has, you can call our crisis line number, which is 816-531-0233. And we also have a website. It's just moxa.org, and that hotline number is on there as well. But you can call that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You will always get a live person answering the phone who's there to answer your questions. You can call anonymously as well. So we keep everything confidential. That's very important to us. So
one question. I think most people think of sexual assault as a problem for women rather than men. But mm-hmm. as you've mentioned, men too can be victims. Is there any kind of difference in how men and women experience or process their victimization?
I don't think so. You know, I think that no matter who this happens to, that it's really difficult. I think that we as society probably treat men and women differently. So in that sense, you might have a different experience. I do think it can be more difficult sometimes for men to come forward because we expect men to be strong, not to cry, to be aggressive, you know. So sometimes when men do come forward, they, you know, people might be like, well, how could that happen to you? You know, so it makes it more difficult for men to come forward, I think, sometimes. So in that sense, they might have a different experience. But I do think that trauma can impact us all in the same way. And I haven't mentioned this yet, but, you know, we know that experience of sexual abuse and assault can lead to chronic health conditions. Sometimes people will turn to substance abuse to cope with the feelings that they're having. It can make it difficult for people to maintain healthy relationships, to hold on jobs. So it's really important if you've experienced that you can get healing and help. And that's available at MOXA, and you can start by calling that crisis line number with questions that you have.
Well, Melanie Austin, thank you so much for being with us today. That was Melanie Austin, Director of Education at the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. And now to the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
We've certainly been focused on the opioid crisis, the international implications thereof, but there's perhaps a solution to at least part of these problems, and here to talk about it is the Deputy Director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Mr. Paul Armentano. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
Oh, Paul, I'm looking at Normal's website. There's something that's caught my attention, that the Normal Group and the Students for Sensible Drug Policy are going to co-host a gubernatorial debate there in Connecticut. That's a sign of progress, is it not?
It most definitely is a sign of progress. It's a sign that not only are politicians evolving on the issue of marijuana policy reform, but it also shows that our movement is maturing, and we are being seen more and more as a serious political player in these sort of electoral politics.
I bring this up because here locally in the city of Houston, the police chief, the sheriff, the district attorney, the commissioners, everybody is calling for a change. And I think one of the things that has caught their attention is the fact that many studies, many reports are beginning to show that the use of cannabis can diminish, if not, get rid of people's opioid addictions. And you've done some studies in that regard, have you not, sir?
Well, there are now roughly 30 peer-reviewed studies in the literature assessing this relationship between marijuana and opioids. And what we see consistently from the literature is that in jurisdictions where patients have legal access to cannabis, their use of opioids decreases, their likelihood of abusing opioids decreases, the incidences of hospitalizations due to opioids decreases, and arguably most importantly, opioid-related mortality, both from prescription opiates and from illicit drugs like heroin, falls significantly in jurisdictions where marijuana is legal. And I think the candidates, at least some of the candidates in this Connecticut gubernatorial race, are taking this same strategy.
Now, that's, a state situation. I was talking about, county and city officials here in Texas. But at the federal level, we are gaining some traction. We aren't exactly up and running as fast as we want to go, but there is some impetus there as well, right?
Well, again, the federal battle in many ways is very different. You have to deal with largely Republican leadership. You have to deal with heads of certain committees who are really reluctant to move forward with regard to this issue, and it makes the opportunities for enacting changes at the federal level, very few and far between. It also allows those opportunities to be quashed by literally just one or two members of Congress. So while our overall support at the federal level is growing in numbers, it is hard sometimes to see that tangible support reflected in legislative change, because literally there are a handful of about half a dozen lawmakers in Congress that are literally holding back any sort of reform from taking place.
Yeah, I've heard it said many times that if they were allowed to vote in secret, marijuana would be legalized today, but that's for another day, I suppose.
Well, at this point, I think we're actually in a situation where if they were simply allowed to vote, we would win many of those battles. But the reality is that there are, again, simply a handful of members who run certain committees. Peter Sessions from Texas, who runs the House Ways and Means Committee, for instance, has stifled the opportunity for House members to vote on any marijuana issue this year. In the Senate, for instance, Charles Grassley, the Republican senator from Iowa, who heads the Judiciary Committee, has blocked any opportunity to vote on marijuana law reform in the Senate. We're literally talking about a handful of politicians who have the ability to squash the will of the majority in Congress.
Again, that was Paul Armentano, Deputy Director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, out there on the web at norml.org. It's a tempest in a teapot, a hurricane in a thimble, drug war, the lie that lasts forever. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.